Tell me a little bit about the origins of this book, because almost everybody who works in the presidential administration has something to say. You become, in one way or another, a part of history. And so you have a story to tell, and you want to explain it, and you want to share your role in it. And sometimes it's easier to do that with a perspective of a couple of years. So tell me a little bit about when you were press secretary, were you keeping records and notes?
Not really in what is, I think, considered the normal sense. In fact, I made a conscious decision not to do that and told my colleagues in the White House that I was not keeping a diary. I was not taking notes for posterity, primarily because the press secretary's job depends so much on his ability to get quickly from colleagues in the White House or in other parts of the government their best assessment of what is happening at the time. And you don't want people, if you're calling up with reporters banging on your door and you're trying to find out what's going on so you can tell them what's going on, you don't want somebody at the other end of the phone saying, oh my goodness, now is he writing this down? Is he going to 4 years later come back and write one of these kiss and tell books in which he makes me look foolish because I gave him my best judgment at the moment and with hindsight it doesn't look so good? So I did not do that. That may have been an overreaction, as a matter of fact, and although I would not have written that sort of Who Shot John book from inside the White House, I in some ways would like to have those recollections for my own personal use and all that. This book, the idea for it really developed very near the end of the administration. I began to think about what I wanted to do next. And at the beginning, frankly, it was going to be a much more academic in tone, and I'm sure people in the press would probably say a much more balanced sort of book. The more I worked with that, the more obvious it became to me that that was not the sort of book I was writing, that I wanted to write, that I had some very strong feelings about what was wrong with the way the press covers government, and that I was really deceiving myself and, to some extent, readers by trying to place it in some artificial format. So I ended up writing a book that was just that, a critique of the press with no pretense of trying to describe what's great and wonderful and good about the Fourth Estate, but rather what's wrong and then needs to be changed.
Jerry Powell, you didn't write the book off the top of your head. What about your files and records?
Oh, certainly, yes. That you always have, and particularly in a press operation in the White House, there is a tremendous amount of daily record keeping. Every briefing that a press secretary does, for example, is transcribed, and those are available. The notes that you prepare each day that you brief, and sometimes you brief maybe twice, three times a day, those are all there in file for you to look back at. Every White House for the past 20 years, I guess, and maybe before then, has produced what is known as a White House news summary, in which each day major stories relating to the president or administration or government policy from all the networks and the major newspapers and the wires and a lot of regional papers around the country are summarized. So you have that sort of thing to go back to. But what I didn't do and what I was not interested in doing anyway was a memoir of sort of my years in the Carter White House. It's not about the Carter White House, it's about the press.
Well, that doesn't rule out the possibility of a memoir about the Carter White House in the future, does it?
In my case, it really does. I think there are other people, basically, who can do a better job of describing for history and posterity how policies were made and how the organization was set up and that sort of thing. And they've done so. The president's done an excellent book on that. Other people, Dr. Brzezinski, Cy Vance, and so forth, have done those. Harold Brown have done those sort of books. That's not me.
You had no journalistic background before you took the job, did you?
No, I didn't. And there's no doubt it would have been helpful for me if I had spent some time working in the press. I think, and for one thing, it always helps to have walked a mile in the shoes of the people that you're dealing with. You understand their problems and their frustrations and what's likely to send them up the wall a little bit better, and I had to try to compensate for that by hiring people to work with and for me who did have that sort of background, and they did a tremendous job of filling in those gaps in my experience and propping me up in areas that I was dealing with for the first time.
Of course, there, even if a professional journalist becomes the White House news secretary, there's still of them and us atmosphere that develops. Herb Klein found that to be the case, and Ron Nessen, for example. So I don't think that you're protected just because you have a journalistic background.
No, you really aren't. And as a matter of fact, it can cut both ways. Watching people that worked either in the White House press office or in the press operations for the various departments, many of whom did have extensive journalistic backgrounds, it was interesting to me the different sort of reactions you saw. For some of them, it made life a good bit more difficult, and a few of them, I think, left government primarily because of the problems created by the fact that they had come out of journalism. They knew in a very personal way these reporters that used to be their friends and colleagues and now were covering them. And there's a nature of the business that sooner or later either the press spokesman, you know, or the reporter is going to have to do something that makes the other's life considerably more difficult than it would have been otherwise. That's an irritant in a relationship anyway. If it's not just how could so-and-so do that, but how could that so-and-so who used to be my good friend, who sat in my house, bounced my children on his knee, drank my good liquor, you have a personal dimension there that makes it worse. Plus, I think for some of them, it was quite a shock to see the profession that they had given their life to suddenly from a very different perspective. And I had a number of rather long, somewhat philosophical conversations with people who had come out of the Washington Press Corps into government and for the first time were beginning to say, oh my gosh, I never realized.
Seems to me the Reagan administration was toying with this legislation that would have prevented governmental employees from writing about the administration after the administration wrapped up its tenure in office. Legislation like that would undoubtedly preclude a book like yours.
Actually, I could probably have written this book. It would have been a tremendous pain in the sense that I would have had to send the thing through some sort of government bureaucracy to have them sort through it. And if there were any news in it, it would probably leak out ahead of time and it would delay publication. That legislation was one of the silliest, stupidest ideas that has come along in a long time. I think the administration has finally given up on the thing, reluctantly. But you know, there is a bit of a problem occasionally. It's a minimal sort of thing. That occasionally you will get someone who has been in government who will, I think, in the few times it's happened, it's mostly inadvertently sort of say something that just might be have been better left unsaid from a national security standpoint. But the problem is so small compared to the problem that these folks were about to create. It's hard, Frankie, to figure how grown men and women managed to come up with an idea like that and stay with it as long as these folks did.
Well, what happens, I think, is that when an administration takes office, there's always a honeymoon period and everybody's happy and everybody gives the new administration a chance. But something happens, usually about a third of the way through, and every administration that I've seen, going back to the ones that I've been following closely since I was eligible to vote, began with the Kennedy administration, and something happens where the honeymoon is over, and sides are drawn, and the battle lines are drawn, and the administration takes a tough stance, and there is usually, I don't know that it developed so much in the Carter administration, I don't think it did, you could fill me in on that, but usually there are concerns about leaks, who is leaking such and such to the Washington Post, we've got to close it up, nobody's allowed to speak to any reporters unless they get clearance from Herb Klein or whatever, And doesn't this happen? It happens.
Certainly. I think you almost have to divide the history of the relationship between press and government, particularly press and the White House, into two periods. Everything before about 1963 or 4, 65, and then from 1965 on until today, because things fundamentally changed after the end of the Kennedy administration, during the early part of the Johnson administration. Some of that change was healthy. I think to some extent in the years before, the relationship between press and government, particularly between presidents and journalists, perhaps was too close. It bordered on incest. I think you had journalists that weren't quite sure whether they wanted to be the representatives of the American public, providing them with information about what was going on within the government, or whether they wanted to be advisors to the prince, sitting around drinking scotch up in the upstairs in the White House. So that part was good, but you also, in that distancing, developed a great deal of suspicion and fear and cynicism on both sides. And you're exactly right. There are ups and downs, but generally speaking, as an administration spends more time in office, the path is one of a deteriorating relationship with the Fourth Estate. Now, part of that is the problem of people in government, but part of it is also a problem, a fault of the people in the press, or certainly the institution in the way it operates. And that was my purpose, was to critique the criticizers, if you will, and talk about some of their problems, even as they talk about the many problems that exist in government.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to ask you a little bit about that, although the book speaks for itself. Can you, in a nutshell, outline your big beef against the way the White House was covered?
I'll do my best. Two things. First of all, it seems to me that the big problem in journalism, the biggest bias, is not philosophical, it's not ideological, it's not partisan, it's not Democrats or Republicans or liberal or conservative. It's a bias that's fundamentally economic in its origins. The fact that news has to sell, it has to be interesting, it has to be somewhat exciting. That is, I think, the predominant thing that pulls reporters along. Nothing wrong with that on its face, but on occasion, the interest of being interesting and the demands of being accurate and balanced and fair part company. My second concern is that it seems to me that the press and journalism is too self-satisfied and not nearly self-critical enough, and that there is a tremendous reluctance to admit error, to correct mistakes, to even deal seriously with the possibility that there might be some fundamental problems in the way that institution operates. And certainly there is almost a total absence, I've on occasion called a conspiracy of silence within journalism, about people in that profession who frequently and as a matter of habit violate even the most minimal standards of accuracy and ethical behavior.
There's a tendency on the part of some, and not necessarily yourself, although once in a while I think you do this, you say the press does. Mm. But what do we mean by the press? Are we talking about the Reader's Digest, the Rolling Stone, CBS, WMAL, mm. that's still there in Washington?
Yes, it is.
Are we talking about the newspaper in Marietta, Georgia? Are we talking about the AP? Are we talking about some of these little rags, political rags that are published in Washington, names of which I can't recall? Who are we talking about when we talk about the press?
That's a point well taken in my case, and I couldn't think of a short term to use that defined it very well. In my case, I'm basically talking about those organs, both print and broadcast, that that are considered national, that have an impact there in Washington and by a ripple effect across the country. The New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Washington Star, when it was still published, the news magazines to some extent, and the networks. You would really have to say now, I suppose, four networks primarily. But those, for the most part, when I talk about the press, the media, I'm talking about sort of national news organizations that provide most of the information that the
many
country...
Many of these organizations are so big that they don't know what's going on within the organization. CBS, for example, you may be in a position to be interviewed at CBS in any number of places by any number of people. You could be interviewed in our FM operation upstairs, conceivably, one of their talk shows. We have several shows here, broadcasts, we don't call them shows, that you could be interviewed on. Different people doing it, different people, different broadcasters, different layers over on the TV. We have a TV broadcast center on 57th Street, and you could be interviewed there, unknown to me. You could be interviewed on one of the little network radio shows. Dan Rather has one. Somebody writes and produces for him. They could interview you. You could be on the morning news. So there are hundreds of people within CBS alone, any one of which could take a single story and deal with it the way he wants.
I think that's true in a general sense, although it is generally not true insofar as coverage of the White House is concerned. You are dealing with a relatively small and fixed number of people from CBS in the White House, and what the American public hears about the White House from CBS, the responsibility for the credit of the blame is generally not that hard to determine. You're dealing with a reasonably rational chain of command system there. Although you raise one point, as a matter of fact, that I really hadn't considered before. You know, one of the hardest things to assess, and when you start talking about this, is radio. Because you don't have, for example, the White House produces a transcript every evening of the CBS Evening News. What you will not have, though, at the end of the day, or certainly at the end of the month, is a record of everything that is said on all the many CBS radio broadcasts. So in most analyses of the press, of the media, I think radio gets neglected, and it is neglected to a great extent in this book, too.
Well, it's a shame. My station reaches a bigger audience than almost all of the television stations.
There's no doubt about it, and that's one of the reasons too. I think it has a financial impact on radio too. I know from speaking with a political hat on, I think radio often gets neglected by political candidates and political office holders because the product is not. They don't see it every day, and so. They do an interview or they deal with the radio, and it's out there. Rationally, they know it is reaching tens of thousands or in some cases millions of people, but they have no proof of it. They're not seeing that. A transcript right in front of them like they do if it's the New York Times or the Associated Press or something like that.
Yes, it's true. When I do a lot of interviews with authors, and some of them are very pleased to have an article about them in a weekly newspaper, and they can look at it. They have it there. They can
fondle it, put it in their scrapbook. Yeah, exactly.
400 people, and ultimately line a canary cage. But they've had it. Something specific. That's why people ask me for cassettes all the time because they want to have something to hold. Well, to kind of wrap things up, you have a couple of recommendations, which disturbed me a little bit. Did I have the right chapter?
There's sort of two concluding chapters here. One concluding, I think, the one with recommendations, and there you go.
Well, one of the ones is that you had recommended that reporters have a financial disclosure.
Yes, I think that would. I think for one thing, that would help with the degree of confidence that people have in journalism. I think it is almost as serious if, let's say, a reporter for CBS News or for the New York Times who's covering energy and thereby in a position to shape energy policy or to help determine the final shape of it, has a financial conflict and a personal interest in that policy, as if some third level bureaucrat in the energy department. I know that there are all sorts of journalists in Washington who have much more influence on national policy or in a much better position to influence its ultimate nature than, let's say, the third-ranking person in the White House press office. We require, as a matter of course, that these people in government reveal any financial entanglements that they might have. We don't make that sort of demand, and most news organizations don't even make it internally about the people who are reporting about the medium. And I think I can't see why anyone would object if you're covering the White House on a regular basis. It seems to me perfectly fair to ask that you make the same sort of information available about your finances and entanglements and possible conflicts as the people who are there in the White House. I also happen to think that it might help journalists to walk a mile in the shoes of people in government on occasion and to understand as they sit down to make that list the sort of questions that might be raised.
Well, I can understand why people might object to your proposal. One, journalists are not governmental employees. They're private citizens. And I don't know that the government, I don't know that you would propose this in terms of legislation or if this would be a voluntary demand on the part of the news organizations. But private citizens are not required to make financial disclosures except to the Internal Revenue Service. And it would seem to me very unfair to single out journalists because they're private people and they're not employed by the government.
They're not employed by the government, but neither are they private citizens in the general sense of the word. They like people in government, I suppose I should say we like people in government, you know, are an elite. We enjoy, as journalists, rights and privileges that are not accorded to the average citizen. If you don't believe that, try to get into to a White House press conference sometime, or try to get a transcript of the press secretary's briefing, or try to get on the plane to follow the president when he goes to China. If you're a journalist, you have a good chance of doing that. If you're a private citizen, you don't. And I think for journalists as well as for government employees, with those rights and privileges and power, should come an extra degree of responsibility and accountability. And I would certainly prefer if news organizations would do it on their own. Failing that, I would have no problem myself as a journalist if I apply for a White House to be a part of the White House press corps and I get that White House pass and filling out and handing in the same sort of forms about my financial entanglements, you know, making them available to the public just like I did when I served in the White House.
Are you talking about White House reporters only?
Well, I think that is a good place to start. And you can get so far to this thing that you get it enmeshed in detail. But it seems to me that a good general proposition would be is that those reporters accredited to cover a particular part of government subject themselves to the same types of financial disclosure as the people in that government. If you're accredited to the Hill to cover the Congress, then fill out the same form that people in the Congress do. If you're accredited to cover the White House, fill out. It's a fairly short, brief little form. And it's not as though, I mean, we're not talking just theory here. I mean, we've got a couple of stories going on right now in which journalists have allegedly, and actually in some cases it's already been admitted, abused their power as journalists for financial gain. Some people at the Wall Street Journal, and I think there's certainly an allegation about some people at CBS using their power as a journalist in an illegitimate fashion to make money in the stock market.
Now, Jody Powell, you are on the ABC payroll and you have a syndicated column. You would have no objections to.
No, my finances are not particularly complicated, I might say. But I think it would be a healthy thing. You know, I travel around and make speeches. I lecture, and I get paid for it. Well, it strikes me that the public might have a right to know whether Jody Powell or a lot of other people who do the same thing and who are a good bit better known and more influential journalists than I are accepting fairly large speaking fees from, in a consistent way, from a particular type of organization. In fact, I did a column on it some time ago. But I was heading down to make a speech to a bankers association in New Orleans, I believe. And it occurred to me as I was heading down there that I had just filed a column a week or so before, in which I had been quite critical of something that the bankers were strongly in favor were trying to do. That is, say, I supported the interest withholding thing. And it occurred to me that if I had come down on the other side of that issue, that people might raise some legitimate questions. Look, is Powell what's he doing here? Is he expressing his opinion, or is he expressing an opinion he's being paid to express? So I think, and most news organizations don't know, for example, who else might be paying large sums of money to their editorial employees. And I think it's a dangerous business.
Just parenthetically, I had, when I came here 16 years ago, I had to sign a document indicating that we could not accept gratuities. It was a rather detailed document that followed on the heels of some payola scandals.
Oh, sure, gratuities, yes. And I had to sign that same sort of document, too. But we're talking about something of the peddling of influence is a good bit more sophisticated than that these days. And if you're an important journalist and you can get invited to make a series of four speeches to employees of let's say Mobil or Exxon or you name it. $4,000 or $5,000 a speech. Well, if you're covering energy as a major issue, at least people have a right to know that you've got a lot of money flowing into you from a from an organization that has a very direct interest in what you say on the air, what you write in the newspaper every day.
Jody Powell, just about out of time, but there was one other recommendation I wanted to that you had made that I wanted to ask you about. And this was your belief that one news organization should refute other news organizations when the facts are wrong in the first report. Do you really believe that CBS, for one example, is going to take the time and resources to try to refute a story on ABC?
Well, whether they will do it or not, I don't know. I think they should. And the refutation is only one consequence that I hope would flow from a more general change in attitude, and that is that it seems to me that journalism ought to be more self-critical. And it seems to me that CBS has an obligation, as a matter of fact, if ABC has blown a story and thereby misinformed tens of millions of people, to answer the legitimate questions that American people have about why that happened. Now, who is responsible? What's being done to keep it from happening again? Certainly, if a government spokesman stood up and misinformed the American public, there would be no concern at all here at CBS about devoting a fair amount of time and effort and resources and energy to determining why that happened. And the fact of the matter is that and the ability to reach large numbers of people, there are several people at CBS and the other networks, too, that are much more powerful than any government spokesman, including the White House press secretary. I think it is a legitimate matter of public interest. Beyond that, that's a recommendation almost out of desperation, because I don't want to see government sticking its nose in, trying to set standards and that sort of thing. And the only alternative I see is for the press to clean up its own mess and for journalists to begin to apply some of the same standards of ethics and competence to their fellows that they do to important and powerful people in other institutions in this society.
Jody Powell, my last question to you. Have you sent a copy of the other side of the story to President Carter?
I have indeed. I haven't heard from him yet, so I don't know what he thinks of this, but I expect to see him in a few days, so I guess he'll tell me.
Are you having an ongoing relationship since the Luck office?
I stay in touch. I obviously don't get a chance to see him as often as I once did, but stay in touch by telephone, and it's really a much more pleasant, relaxed sort of relationship. We can just sort of gossip about what's going on in Georgia, what's going on in Washington now, without having to be particularly worried about what may happen next.
You miss Georgia.
I miss Georgia. I miss the South, I guess, a little bit. Although Washington is still a bit of a southern city, and I look forward one of these days to moving back down there where the hunting and fishing's good and the life is a little more relaxed and polite and gentle.
That's what the ads in broadcasting magazines say sometimes when they're looking for a news director in some godforsaken area of Montana. Great hunting and fishing. Work morning drive shift. Six days a week.
I suspect we, depending on where we come from, we might disagree on which part of the country's God has indeed forsaken, as a matter of fact.
Well, if you want to be a newsman, I don't know if you... If you want to hunt and fish, I think Montana's God's country.
I'm not sure whether God believes. I suspect he approves of fishing and hunting more than news directing, too.
Johnny Powell, thank you very much for
talking
to me.